Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. If you've listened to this show over the last 4 years, I think I've shed light on enough of the facts to prove that the official story of 9/11 is a lie. From the omissions and distortions of the 9/11 Commission and the confessions of the commissioners themselves, we can see that we were lied to and that there's a cover-up going on. The official story falls apart at almost any point of entry if one just looks below the surface, even slightly. From the FBI stating in 2006 that Osama bin Laden wasn't wanted for 9/11 because they had no hard evidence linking him to the crime, and you may be wondering why the corporate media hasn't told you about that, to the currently 1,656 architects and engineers who have proven, using the laws of physics, that the towers, all three of them, even the one that wasn't hit by a plane, came down by controlled demolition. I could go on with literally hundreds of examples like these, disproving the official story of 9/11. Why is 9/11 still important? Because the consequences have been and continue to be so great. Because 9/11 and the endless war on terror have been used and continue to be used to threaten your civil liberties and destroy your constitution. They've been used to justify attacking Afghanistan and Iraq, and now perhaps Iran, with the deaths of over a million people so far. And another consequence is the trillions of dollars being spent on the wars that have drained our treasury. And somebody's benefiting from that. Here's part of what James Hufford has to say in an article that was posted on 911truth.org on January 11th, 2012. The title is "The Stakes Have Never Been Higher," and here goes. Most of the recent big, commonly noticeable, and objectionable changes in our controllable circumstances in America, including many downright atrocities, have happened since September 11, 2001, and a goodly number of them have developed as a direct consequence. Although that day still seems, in many ways, very recent, it appears to have marked not only a beginning of our current and accumulating woes, but also the end of a long age of relative bliss, freedom, and a degree of personal opportunity that we haven't experienced since. My supposition, which I voiced here before, is that 9/11 wasn't just an inside job, but rather was done at the bequest of an international elite firmly in control of our government and corporate establishment, as well as those in other countries, the main trunk of the giant controlling octopus being international central banking. Sounds like he's talking about the global 1%, doesn't it? Well, it's my belief that the researchers and scientists have done such a great job in uncovering many of the facts about 9/11 and disproving the official conspiracy theory that the only thing standing in the way of stopping the wars and the trashing of our Constitution is mass exposure of these facts about 9/11. Although the truth movement doesn't have the complete story on what happened that day, we have enough facts to disprove the official story many times over. Since being involved in researching 9/11, I've come to learn just how profoundly the corporate media is a propaganda arm of the shadow government. The holes in the official conspiracy of 9/11 are so huge that the only way the perpetrators have gotten away with it is because of their control of the corporate media. So, it looks like we're on our own. It's up to us to get the facts out, so please do everything you can to help with this. If we reach the tipping point, and I think we're close to it, it could profoundly change our world for the better. And now, first you're going to hear General Wesley Clark discussing how he learned about the seven countries that are on the neocons hit list. And then the focus will turn to Iran. So here's General Wesley Clark.
He said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. So I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda? He said, no, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. He said, I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran. The truth is about the Middle East is, had there been no oil there, it would be like Africa. Nobody is threatening to intervene in Africa. The problem is the opposite. We keep asking for people to intervene and stop it. And there's no question that the presence of petroleum throughout the region has sparked great power involvement. Whether that was the specific motivation for the coup or not, I can't tell you, but there's always been this attitude that somehow we could intervene and use force in the region.
So as you just heard, Iran is one of the 7 countries on the neocons hit list, along with Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Lebanon. Well, you already know what happened to Iraq and Libya, and we'll talk more about the other countries on future broadcasts. And now you're going to hear a brief clip explaining the U.S.-Iranian relationship since the 1950s. I think it's important and valuable to know that history. The clip is called The History of Iran-American Relations and was posted on YouTube on November 11, 2009. And here goes.
For most Americans, the story begins in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. A group of revolutionary university students took over the American embassy in Tehran and held 52 diplomats hostage for 444 days. To help burn this into the American narrative, the news show Nightline was created with a nightly tally of the number of days since the crisis started. But to really understand, we have to go back to 1953, which is where the story begins for most Iranians. This was the year that the U.S. overthrew Iran's democracy and installed the Shah, a pro-U.S. dictator. In 1951, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh was the first elected official who was appointed as Prime Minister of Iran by popular demand. He saw that the wealth needed to build Iran was leaving the country because over the past 50 years, its vast oil reserves were under British control at the hands of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, later to become BP, or British Petroleum. So Mossadegh became hugely popular for nationalizing the oil industry and taking back the oil. Hugely popular at home, but quite unpopular with the British government. Britain took Iran to the world court over the matter and lost. They tried to hit Iran's economy by blockading the Gulf and halting trade. They tried to convince the U.S. to assist with regime change, but then President Truman was not interested. However, when U.S. President Eisenhower took office in 1953, Britain was able to persuade him under the Cold War pretext that Mossadegh relied on Iran's Communist Party for power. The newly formed CIA was sent to engineer a coup, codenamed Operation Ajax. Iran's monarch, the Shah, returned to power. He had previously been weakened by the new parliament, a short democratic experiment designed to limit his powers. After 1953, he returned fully backed by UK and US power, and the oil was soon flowing under control of Britain, America, the Netherlands, and France. The Shah became increasingly arrogant, opulent, and autocratic over his 25-year rule. He instilled fear in the population with a secret police known as Savak, created by the American CIA and Israeli Mossad, that tortured and imprisoned those who dared to dissent. He crushed all political opposition. Troops were sent to massacre demonstrators. He pushed a white revolution to modernize and westernize the country, giving women the right to vote and other reforms. But ultimately, he served the elites and created a huge economic gap for the poor masses. Powerful religious leaders saw that he was forcibly trying to rid Iran of Islam in a country that was 90% Muslim. One of the Shah's leading critics, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, was arrested and imprisoned for 18 months. After his release in 1964, Khomeini was sent into exile for 14 years. From abroad, he continued his anti-US, anti-Shah campaign through sermons on cassette tapes that made their way back into Iran and circulated as people copied and shared them. By the end of the 1970s, things had gotten so bad that major protests and the violence that followed were becoming a regular occurrence. The Shah declared martial law and banned demonstrations. This resulted in a huge protest and a general strike that shut down the economy. Soon over 2 million people flooded a public square in Tehran, demanding to remove the Shah and for Khomeini to return. And that is exactly what happened. One important thing to note is that the CIA orchestrated the 1953 coup out of the very same American embassy in Tehran that was later the site of the hostage crisis, right after the Shah was overthrown by popular revolution in 1979. The students were convinced that once again, the U.S. had plans to overthrow their revolution. In fact, U.S. President Carter did send a NATO general to instigate a military coup, but it failed. Iran and the U.S. had an extradition treaty in force that obligated the Carter administration to return the Shah to Iran as an indicted criminal. The students had four demands. Return the Shah to Iran for trial. He had been accepted into America for medical treatment. Return the Shah's wealth to the Iranian people. A promise from the U.S. not to interfere in Iran's affairs in the future. And an apology and admission of guilt by the U.S. for its past actions in Iran. The apology never came, but 20 years later, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright did acknowledge the U.S. role in Mossadegh's overthrow. So Khomeini took power in 1979 and instituted a government under Islamic law. Within a year of the revolution, Saddam Hussein invaded Iran without provocation, seeking control of Iran's oil-rich Khuzestan region and key oil shipping waterways. The resulting Iran-Iraq War from 1980 to 1988 was the longest and one of the most devastating conventional wars of the century. At least 500,000 Iranians were killed. This war further cemented resentment of the U.S. government as they were playing both sides. On one hand, they were supporting Iraq, providing money, technology, and intelligence, including satellite photography, to help Iraqi bombing raids. The U.S. helped provide Saddam Hussein with weapons by giving him agricultural credits and pressuring Gulf states to give him billions in loans so he could buy weapons from Western Europe, China, and Russia. The U.S. Department of Commerce issued licenses to export materials for Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program. The U.S. continued its support even after learning that Iraq was using chemical weapons against Iran, not to mention against its own citizens, to stop an uprising of Kurdish separatists. But the imperialist tradition also called for maintaining regional balance of power. So the U.S. also armed Iran, not letting any one regional power get secure enough to dominate or to ally with its neighbors to challenge U.S. hegemony. In this case, it came in the form of the Iran-Contra scandal. U.S. President Reagan needed money to fund an unjustified war against Nicaragua, but was forbidden to do so by Congress. So U.S. arms were illegally sold to Iran through Israel and South Africa, and the proceeds went to the Nicaraguan Contras. This allowed Reagan to get around Congress to support a campaign of kidnap, rape, torture, and murder, for which the U.S. was convicted by the World Court for unlawful use of force. In other words, state-sponsored international terrorism. The ruling was ignored. Khomeini died in 1989, shortly after the war ended. He promised democracy, but essentially had become the next dictator. Although he improved literacy and much-needed health care for the masses, he also imposed censorship, violently crushed political dissent, and attacked women's rights. Instead of the Savak, the people now had the Revolutionary Guard to fear. Since then, Iran has been an oppressive theocracy. Khomeini was replaced by Khamenei, who remains supreme leader to this day. As a test of fairness, we might imagine that Iran invaded and occupied Canada and Mexico and had aircraft carriers sitting in the Caribbean. Imagine then if Iran had the power to label the U.S. the axis of evil and cut us off from the rest of the world, and then threatened to attack us if we didn't stop generating nuclear power. What if Iran had overthrown the U.S. government 50 years ago and installed a dictator friendly to Iranian interests, who kept it in power for 25 years? At that point, imagine that Christian fundamentalists, who currently represent about a third of the U.S., took power and began ruling under church law, followed by an unprovoked invasion by Canada, supported by Iran and ignored by the UN, in which it nearly destroyed the U.S. Would it be possible to imagine Iran as liberators? Would Iran be justified in attacking if the U.S. government helped Christian fundamentalists in Canada to take up resistance? Would it be justified to hate and fear all Christians because of the ones that took and abused power in this context? This is not about good guys and bad guys. Both the American and Iranian governments are working against the interests of the people. But the deadly game of chicken was begun by the U.S., and the U.S. has the power to end it. We should look at our current policies and actions against Iran, look at some better options, and figure out a way to change the minds of the people running our government and prevent another criminal enterprise that will cost many more lives. It has been done in the past, and if people take action, it can be done again.
And now here's Michelle Chusadovsky of globalresearch.ca talking about the history of the current threat to Iran.
It is absolutely essential to address the history of this military agenda directed against Iran, including the role of Israel. As I mentioned, the main coalition partners are the United States, NATO, and Israel. But among the NATO partners, Turkey plays a very key role in this regard. The plan to attack Iran, using as a pretext its alleged nuclear weapons program, has been in an advanced state of readiness since 2005. This is a centralized operation out of a strategic command headquarters in Nebraska. It involves liaison logistics with the major partners of the alliance. It contemplates both theater operations as well as covert operations, using a panoply of sophisticated weapon systems so that covert operations, destabilization of command and control, communication systems, the array of cyber attacks using technologies, electromagnetic technologies to destabilize communication systems, institutions, supply routes, all of these are contemplated, and the drone attacks are part of that agenda. I think what recent developments suggest is that Iran has developed its own capabilities in terms of cyber warfare, command and control, counter operations, to the extent that it was able to down the U.S. drone and have it land on Iranian territory, which signifies that it has abilities to change the course and direction of this unmanned aerial vehicle. But we must, I think, address the fact that these operations, these covert operations, constitute potentially the first phase of an all-out attack on the Islamic Republic of Iran. Such an operation to attack either Iran or Syria is in blatant derogation of international law. It is classified as a war of aggression under international law. It is a crime against the peace under Nuremberg. And it should be very clear that if the United Nations Security Council or any other international body were to support this military agenda of attacking or invading a sovereign country on any pretext, it is complicit in the violation of international law and in the project of crimes against the peace under Nuremberg.
And now here's Michelle Trusadovsky on a recent interview on Russia Today. You'll notice that 9/11 is used again to justify another war.
Now, a U.S. court has won a default judgment that Iranian officials, including its supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, provided help to the 9/11 hijackers behind the worst terror attack on American soil. The lawsuit was filed by the families of the atrocity's victims. There was no Iranian representation in the court. It's an interesting story, this. Let's talk to Michelle Trusadovsky, director of the Center for Research on Globalization. He's on the line from Montreal. Michelle, evening. What do you make of this case? Do you believe Iran aided the 9/11 attacks?
Well, there's absolutely no evidence that Iran aided the 9/11 attacks. There's ample evidence after collection of evidence that there was conspiracy and complicity at the highest levels of the U.S. government. The narrative of the 9/11 Commission report has been refuted by numerous scholars and writers and journalists, intelligence analysts. There is absolutely no evidence that Al-Qaeda or the Taliban were involved in the 9/11 attacks. In fact, if there's anybody behind Al-Qaeda, it was the Central Intelligence Agency going back to the Soviet-Afghan War. Afghanistan was invaded on the pretext that they had attacked America. It was stated on the morning of September 12, 2001. It was the pretext also for NATO's involvement under Article 5 of the Washington Treaty. And this judgment, in fact, I would consider it as a timely propaganda ploy directed against Iran, where you accuse Iran of 9/11 with a view to waging war on Iran. And that is not the only media disinformation campaign which has now been waged against Tehran. But there's another aspect to that. President Ahmadinejad, earlier this year at the General Assembly of the United Nations, actually made the statement that, or insinuated that the U.S. government was behind the 9/11 attacks, and he questioned the official narrative. Other heads of state and heads of government have done likewise. But what is interesting in Ahmadinejad's statement to the United Nations Security Council is that he not only endorses 9/11 truth,
Shell, as we know, this has been so hotly debated for so many years now, and there are strong feelings in both camps still, even to this day. But just looking at this ruling, what's it going to do now for U.S.-Iranian relations that are already dodgy and are getting worse, by the looks of it?
Well, I think this is really part of the propaganda ploy. You demonize your enemy. You present Iran as a threat to global security, as an upcoming nuclear power which threatens the world. You say that Iran supports the war on terrorism, when in fact the war on terrorism is supported by the United States of America. We see it in Libya, where they actually supported the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, and so on and so forth. So that, in fact, we are dealing with fabrications whereby a war agenda, which has been on the Pentagon's drawing board for many years, now is seeking a justification to go live. And we've seen the drone attacks, we've seen the sanctions regime, we've seen economic sanctions unfolding. Why does the United States want to attack Iran? Because Iran has 10% of the world's oil reserves, 4 or 5 times those of the United States of America. It's in a crucial region. It doesn't accept U.S. hegemony. It's an ally of Russia and China. And I think we must understand that any kind of military operation directed against Iran or directed against Syria could unleash a war which extends from the eastern Mediterranean right through to Central Asia to the Chinese border. And then we are in a World War III scenario. And I should also mention that nuclear weapons are contemplated to be used against Iran, not only by the United States of America and Israel, but also by several non-nuclear states which have nuclear weapons in their respective military bases. And I'm talking about Belgium, Holland, Germany, Turkey, and Italy. They are non-nuclear powers, but they possess made in America tactical nuclear weapons, B-61-11, and these are all targeted at the Islamic Republic of Iran.
And now I'm going to close the show by reading part of an article by Adrian Salbucci that was posted on the website globalresearch.ca on January 19th, 2012. And the title is "The Lessons of Libya: Chaos is No Surprise. The Destruction of Countries by the U.S.-NATO Alliance is Deliberate." And here goes. Throughout history, military attacks on sovereign nations have always meant death, destruction, and chaos, which don't end once invasion is complete. Look at Iraq, Afghanistan, Palestine, Vietnam, Northern Ireland, even World War II and the Cold War. So why should Libya be any different? Today, the Western media are appalled at the continued gunfights among warring factions. Reuters reports that clashes between rival Libyan militias have killed 2 people and wounded 16 in the latest violence involving armed groups refusing to hand in their weapons. What did the West expect? A sovereign country, Libya, was attacked and overrun by NATO forces based on false pretexts supported by a hypocritical UN resolution that led to tens of thousands of Libyans being killed, maimed, their homes and infrastructure bombed, their country ransacked and thrown into utter chaos, its leaders and their children and grandchildren murdered on live TV, causing U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton to publicly roar with laughter. It sounds a lot like the 8 years of Iraqi invasion, where hideous violence reigns to this very day, which sounds like Afghanistan, which sounds like 60 years of daily life in Palestine, which sounds like Serbia 2 decades ago, which sounds like Vietnam 4 decades back. Did the West blow it yet again? I don't think so. The boys and girls doing geopolitical planning at the Council on Foreign Relations, Trilateral Commission, American Enterprise Institute, and AIPAC have far too much experience to stumble over the same stone time and again. Does that mean they destroyed Libya on purpose? Of course they did. The daily pictures we have been fed for almost a year of the hell Libya has become and of the so-called Arab Spring, with armed uprisings backed by the CIA, MI6, Mossad, and NATO, are very eloquent. These Western terror organizations' dirty tricks departments have done a great job. I mean, look at what they're doing now in Iran, where they have no qualms about openly admitting that they are running through the streets of Tehran, murdering scientists and civilians, and bombing facilities and installations. Can anybody provide a clearer example of state-sponsored terrorism than that? Openly admitted by its very perpetrators, Israel, the U.S., and the U.K.? No, the destruction of Libya and other rogue states has served and is serving as a key objective of the global power elite, for it carries a message to the whole world, eloquently warning and threatening every nation on earth, saying, if we can do this to Libya, we can do this to any country we damn want to. You're either with us or against us, runs the 9/11 Baby Bush doctrine. Did you hear that, Venezuela? Did you hear that, Syria? You too, Ecuador, Nigeria, Pakistan, Bolivia? Sure, the distance in time running from threat to action is inversely proportionate to how close the target, quote, rogue state is to China and Russia. In my 30th December 2001 article for Russia Today, 2012, the year of world government, I describe 12 triggers that global power elite embedded in the U.S., U.K., and European Union are using to impose global domination upon us all. Trigger number 10 specifically refers to, quote, attacks on rogue states. You see, there are patterns if you know where to look. For instance, Gaddafi's Libya, Iran, Syria, Venezuela, and many Muslim countries have central banks that are truly independent, but not of local government, as Harvard and CFR eggheads demand, but rather independent of the IMF, Goldman Sachs, Citicorp, and the Rothschild Rockefeller parasitic usury-based global banking cabal. Another pattern, Gaddafi was getting ready to introduce the gold dinar, a currency made of real gold and not just flimsy paper like the dollar and euro, to trade Libyan oil. Libya has the world's 9th largest oil reserves and the largest in Africa. And then, why not? to trade African and Middle Eastern oil too, a direct attack on U.S. dollar hegemony in the oil trade. Another pattern, leaders in countries like Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Serbia have been short-sighted on key geopolitical issues. So when the heat is on them, they invariably find themselves alone in the crossfire. They forge no strategic alliances, and so they are left high and dry. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.